This week on the FAQ City Podcast, WFAE listener Mark Doherty wants to know, where can you find Charlotte's ties to the American Revolution? We travel through time and the Queen City on this week's FAQ City. Download the podcast and contribute your own question on WFAE.org/FAQ City. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For whatever reasons, there are plenty of climate change deniers in the halls of Congress and in state legislatures around the country, including our own. But you won't find those folks among the highest echelons of our military. The United States military says the effects of climate disruption are an accelerant of instability around the world. As temperatures rise or as weather swings to its extremes, water supplies can diminish or disappear, food can become scarce, and rising sea levels can force people from their homes. In countries where governments are not prepared or equipped to deal with this disruption, conflicts could potentially arise, even war. To the military, climate change is a matter of national security. Among those most familiar with the threat is our guest this hour. Retired Marine Corps Brigadier General Stephen Cheney spent over 30 years in the Corps, serving in a variety of capacities. Today, he is the Chief Executive Officer of the American Security Project, a bipartisan organization founded in 2005 to tackle long-term national security challenges unencumbered by political bias. General Cheney is in Charlotte today, under the auspices of the World Affairs Council Charlotte, and joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Mike, I'm pleased to be here.
We are old high school classmates. I want people to know this. I brought in the yearbook just to prove it, although you were 2 years ahead of me. We never spoke because you were a senior and I was a sophomore.
T.C. Williams, remember the Titans.
That's right. The general, by the way, will be speaking today at the World Affairs Council lunch at noon at the Hilton Center City. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And you can join the conversation by getting us through email at charlottetalks@WFAE.org or on Facebook at WFAE or through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And you can watch us on Facebook Live. How is it? Because you live in Alexandria. We both grew up. And you've been in the military for 30 years. And now you're circulating around Washington in your other capacity. How is it that so many politicians are in denial about climate change, or at least say they are in denial about climate change, when the military has been saying now for years this is a matter of national security?
Well, Mike, when you look at the science, it's proven, the facts are there. Now, you still get people that say there's 3% of the meteorologists that claim it's not true, but you got 97% that say it is true. So it's awfully hard to fight those statistics. So from the military perspective, we're always looking ahead to see what the next battle is going to be. So as you're planning, you get to plan 5, 10, 40, 50 years out, depending on the acquisition pipeline for an aircraft carrier, for instance, and you got to think, where is this conflict going to be and what's driving the conflict? Mm-hmm. So we call climate change an accelerant to instability. It's a threat multiplier. You no doubt it's there. And we can pinpoint places, and I can walk all the way around the world with this to show you where it has really exacerbated conflict. Take your choice. Africa, Syria, Bangladesh, Philippines. There are all places that have been severely impacted by climate change. And the military has to plan for conflict that's going to be there.
And in addition to being with the military for so long, you've also done some things with the CIA. You've been awarded by the CIA. You've done things with the State Department as well. Do those agencies, at least up until the recent administration, have those agencies been on board with the military with regard to climate change? And have they changed their stance since the Trump administration?
Well, I think when you look at the career employees of all those agencies, I'm talking the non-political appointees, certainly they've been on board. They understand it. They recognize that it's in all kinds of documents. Certainly in DOD it is. It's been in a national security strategy for over a decade now. So, I mean, from the career perspective, yes, the current administration comes in. They try to take out mentions of climate change, but they still understand that there's going to be conflict that's caused by climate change, but they changed the wording a little bit. But I don't think that's changed anybody's mind among the career people that are there. They clearly understand what it is and what's happening. You have your deniers. I think when you mention the political side, a lot of that's pandering to their base. And they say, hey, the left-wing Sierra Club, environmental type folks say, oh, they're blowing this all out of proportion, which of course we believe at my organization that we're not blowing it out of proportion. But we try to pull it out of that realm and say, okay, let's look at reality here. What's it causing to you today? And I can talk about North Carolina and the impacts you were having here in North Carolina, certainly at Camp Lejeune, factually, to say, hey, here's what it's causing. And it's awfully hard to deny that.
The military seemed to be the tip of the spear on this issue, at least within the government. The military saw this as a threat long before we even really started talking about it, and long before I think people saw evidence, physical evidence, of sea level rise. How was the military so prescient on this issue?
Well, as I mentioned, the planners, what we call J5 planners, we have them in the joint staff. Every department has it. Every service has their planners. And they're looking at long-term contingencies and where they have to protect their assets. I think the poster child in terms of bases and stations is probably the station in Norfolk, the naval base, mm-hmm. the largest naval base in the world. Clearly, it's being inundated by water for two reasons. One, it's actually physically sinking. And the other part is the waters are rising. And they've known this for years. They've measured it. And even the town, Portsmouth and Norfolk, understand that, and they've watched it. So now the Navy has to raise the level of all its piers there. And they've already started doing that.
By how much?
Oh,
well,
you're talking feet. Several feet in some cases. And the problem with that, of course, is the piers all have the electrical connections, and when they go into water, you don't have electricity to power the ships that are docked there.
Right.
So you've got to raise the level of the piers. And, I mean, that's a very poignant example. And then in addition to that, huge flooding and rains have closed that base multiple times every year now, more frequently than ever before.
Is climate change and sea level rise, and I guess they are connected, but is it more of a threat to our security because of the coastal naval bases and marine bases that are going to be inundated by floodwaters, or is it more of a threat to our national security because of what may or may not happen in other parts of the world?
Yeah, I've got about a 30-minute speech on this issue, okay. So I'll split it into two parts, and I call it strategic and tactical. Bases and stations, in my opinion, are tactical. I mean, they're there. You know what's causing the sea level rise. You know you're going to have to move them eventually. Camp Lejeune, for instance, the Outer Banks are going underwater. Marines are going to have to move where they train. But the strategic side is what's going to impact you conflict-wise worldwide. Mm-hmm. And among the many examples I give, for instance, Arab Spring, which you think, oh, climate change didn't cause Arab Spring. Well, it certainly accelerated it. And here's what happened. In 2009 and 2010, there were huge forest fires in Russia. What's the relation here? Devastated the wheat crop. Wheat was their main export to the Middle East. Their main staple there was bread. The prices of wheat went skyrocketing, and in Egypt, particularly in Cairo, they had riots because of the prices. That was an accelerant to the instability and one of the sparks that started the Arab Spring. Mm. Move a little bit farther east and go to Syria, where they had the worst drought in their history, 2006, 2011. All the crops dried up, so the farmers moved to the cities. Which one in particular? Aleppo, which we all know where Aleppo is now, created a huge target for Assad. And he started barrel bombing the people who were there. And ISIS rolls in, takes advantage of this instability, and recruits its members. So, I mean, and you can keep going farther around the world, talk about hurricanes and typhoons. Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, the highest recorded wind speed ever in a typhoon or hurricane. We sent 12,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines to the Philippines to rescue the Filipinos there. 8,000 Filipinos died, by the way, in that particular event. And you say, well, why did we do that? We are the only country in the world that could move that many people that quickly and help in that catastrophe. Only people in the world.
Right.
So we did it as a humanitarian gesture, but nonetheless, we still had to protect our assets and understand where it's being caused. So, I mean, that's all part of this equation.
Right. You, as I said, became CEO of the American Security Project in 2011. What is that?
And I'll give you a little bit of history here. And it started in 2004 with the election. And then Senator Kerry, who got defeated and was not happy about that, came out of that election upset over a number of things, but not the least of which, when he talked climate change, he got somewhat painted as the left-wing liberal he probably is. And people would not listen to him. And he said, can I not get this point across that climate change is a national security threat? And if they're not going to listen to him, he said, who would they listen to? And maybe if I can get some retired generals and admirals, 3- and 4-star in particular, 2 from each service, let them talk the issue, take the politics out of it, maybe people will listen to the message. And that's what he did. So he created the American Security Project, had 4 senators, Kerry Hagel, Hart, and Redman, two Republicans, two Democrats. They founded the organization, pulled in 8 3- and 4-star generals and admirals, and used them as the spokespersons for that issue in particular, but we also do nuclear right. proliferation, asymmetric operations, terrorism, public diplomacy, among others. But that was the genesis of the organization.
Is climate change, your emphasis on climate change, is that the most touchy subject that you deal with? Because I'm sure there's universal agreement about nuclear proliferation and other things.
Well, you say that, but but I mean, when you take a look at what we call the JCPOA, the Iran agreement, which we've been in favor of that for years, of course, and which we have just, the president just pulled out of the Iran agreement. So that's a pretty controversial topic. And we've got military guys can sit there and talk about the benefits of being in that particular agreement and why it was advantageous to our government. But now we're not in it, so it's caused, so that's perhaps just as controversial as some of the other ones we're in.
So the idea behind your organization was, and still is, to take out the partisan bickering in some of these things that you deal with. How do you do that in this hyper-partisan world in which we live?
Well, you know, one of our mantras at ASP has always been, we will not endorse a candidate or a political party. We will criticize or support a policy. And if, for instance, the president comes out and says he's getting out of the JCPOA, we go, here's why you should not abandon that agreement. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the Paris Accord on the climate side, which we were strongly in favor of. Of course, we pulled out of that one too. So, but we wouldn't take particularly a Democratic position on it or a Republican position on it. You know, we will take the national security perspective and, mm-hmm. and pull out those parts of it to say, here's why it's advantageous to the security of the country.
A lot of people look at the military, particularly the leaders in the military, and assume that most of them are Republican and most of them vote Republican. So is it difficult to find people in the military to join your organization who can support issues like climate change that are not traditionally supported by Republicans?
Well, it's interesting you ask that word join. We are not a membership organization. We do have a business council where we have corporate support, and that's how we get part of our funding. We don't take any government funding, by the way, no U.S. government funding at all. So there are no active duty military members of our organization. And on our board, the military members are all retired, okay. Have gotten out of the military. And you, as you probably are well aware, active duty military cannot campaign in political campaigns, be it Republican or Democrat. They're outlawed from doing that. So they will avoid that perspective on it. And the generalization that they're all Republican is probably a little overblown. I said, you just don't know the politics till they retire or get out of the service. And then many are getting into the political realm, as you well know. And I point to some of my very good friends, Jim Mattis, John Kelly. You never knew what their politics were until they got out and, of course, got hooked up with an administration. But right. but on, really, neither one of those two, in fact, ran for office. So they got picked by the administration, obviously, to be the Secretary of Defense and then Secretary of Homeland Security for those two. So on the political side, I would say the more senior you get in the military, the more you understand the impacts of climate change. The junior level, and I'm talking Lance Corporal, Lieutenant, for instance, it's really not high on their mind. They're more concerned, what I call, on the tactical side of what's on the other side of that hill.
Right.
They're not that much concerned with what's causing the conflict in Syria. But in the joint staff, when they're talking long-range planning here, they're real concerned with what's causing the conflict in Syria and where is the next conflict going to be.
I want to talk about North Carolina for a little bit when we come back from the break, because a couple of years ago, the legislature here outlawed it. They outlawed climate change.
Okay.
They passed a law which banned the state from basing coastal policies on the latest scientific predictions of how much the sea level will rise. I don't know that that's still the case, but back then it was, and it just seemed counterintuitive on the face of it. And with all the military bases that we have here, that seems to be at odds with what you know to be true about climate change. We're going to come back and talk more about all of this with Brigadier General Stephen Cheney, who is with the American Security Project, in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
WFAE is proud to launch a new investigative podcast called She Says, which looks at one sexual assault survivor's efforts to bring her assailant to justice. Find out more at WFAE.org/She Says.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Brigadier General Stephen Cheney is with us today. He is the CEO now of the American Security Project, which is a nonpartisan organization that takes a look at long-term security challenges facing the United States, among them, as we've been talking about, climate change, which the military calls an accelerant to disruption. A couple of years ago, as I mentioned, North Carolina State Legislature passed a law which banned the state from basing coastal policies on the latest scientific predictions of how much sea level will rise. It was drafted in response to an estimate by the state's Coastal Resources Commission that sea level will rise here by 39 inches in the next century, which seems like a long time, but it's really not. It's 80 years. And that spawned fears that the cost of insurance for people along the coast would rise, and that would depress prices for property there and reduce development, because who wants to go where it's, who wants to buy a piece of property that's going to be underwater? Yesterday, the Charlotte Observer reported that by 2100, the shoreline at the Wright Brothers National Memorial in Killdevil Hills may be under 32 inches of water. What is the cost of closing our eyes to all of this?
Well, Mike, clearly the Marines in particular, who have many coastal bases and stations, two biggest ones that are prominent are Camp Pendleton in California and Camp Lejeune here in North Carolina. As those beaches erode and go away, those training areas disappear. So we have to go somewhere to train on the coast. And you think in Camp Lejeune, are we, if the coast comes inland further, then you're going to have to find another coastline to do your training. I mean, that's just going to be a fact.
Well, won't we just move inland?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Maybe you could. And it creates a new beach, but it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
But
what's the impact of a 39-inch
sea level? 39 is huge. I mean, that's dramatic, and I actually think that's an underestimate, by the way.
Do you think the time is overestimated? Do you think it'll be here before 2100?
Yes, I do, particularly if the Greenland ice cap starts to melt, which it is. Not the Arctic, as it melts, and it's melting dramatically, will not that much increase the sea level rise, but because it's already floating in the ocean.
Right.
But the Greenland ice cap is on land, and when that melts, you will see dramatic sea level rise. In the terms not of inches, but in feet.
I mean, people who have read about this have probably seen the maps that I think the New York Times and other publications have put out by showing that Florida essentially disappears, and other areas of the country just are in New York City, even Washington, D.C., parts of Washington, because it's a swamp, will soon be underwater or inundated by water.
Sure.
And certain cities are building seawalls and all kinds of. What is the approach in the rest of the world to this threat? Are they putting their heads in the sand too, or are they aggressively taking action?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I belong to a group called the Global Military Advisory Council on Climate Change, and it's got two flag officers from several countries that are addressing this issue. In fact, I mentioned I'm going to Sweden in a couple of weeks, and that's part of that organization. Certainly, they don't have their head in the sand in this regard, but there are some countries where it's far more impacted than it is others. Bangladesh is the poster child that I use. Mm. 1.5-foot level sea level rise causes 20 million refugees. And they know, for instance, that they can't stop that it's going to happen. So they're trying to figure out where they're going to put these 20 million people. And as you're probably familiar, they've got big-time refugee problems there from the Rohingyas coming from Burma. They've got an armed border with India. So people aren't going to either one of those two countries. And when you have that many people, 20 million, there's a good chance they're going to go other places. Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, a big ISIS footprint in Indonesia. So this is going to create huge instability. That's one region. When you look at the Sahel in Africa, where their projected temperatures, ambient temperatures in the summer will go to 140 degrees Fahrenheit,
right.
People can't live there. They're going to move. And as I tell my European friends, you think you have a refugee crisis now because of conflict and people, as we're all familiar with the immigration issues in Europe, wait till you get 20 or 30 million coming from Africa,
right.
Because of climate change. And they're already moving. Look at Lake Chad that's lost 90% of its water in the last two decades. People are moving away from Lake Chad because they can't subsist on it
right.
anymore. And of course, one of the big organizations that's taken advantage of that is Boko Haram. So, I mean, they're walking into that situation. They're taking advantage of the unemployment and the movement. They're recruiting people into their organization, and now, by the way, ISIS is there as well.
Not that it matters, I suppose, but what is the crux of the political point of view that we just can ignore this? Is it that they deny that it's man-made, or is it just the fact that they don't believe this is going to happen?
Yeah, Mike, I'm not a scientist. I'll tell you that up front. But I oftentimes travel with a Navy Rear Admiral called Dave Titley, who used to be the head meteorologist for the Navy, is now running the meteorology section at Penn State University, where he got his doctorate. He can talk days about the science and show you graphs where CO2 in the atmosphere has increased dramatically since the Industrial Revolution. And parallel to that, of course, is the temperature change, which has just gone off the map. And what we should be in now is a cooling period in the world. Our temperatures should actually be going down, but they're going up. So, I mean, when you show that to people and they go, oh, well, we're going to have another ice age. Well, we might have another ice age, but we should be entering that ice age closer to now than we're going. Instead, we're going the other way. And it's man-made. I mean, this is caused by man. So, but you get to deniers who sit there, oh, no, that's not the case. You know,
Well, those people will also say, because I remember this, and you probably do too, years ago, we were supposed to be going into this ice age,
right.
And suddenly it's going in the other direction. So they say, well, it's just weather. I mean, we get the weather forecast wrong all the time. So we got that wrong. I mean, well, it'll come back. It'll turn around, won't it?
I don't think so. Not if we keep polluting the atmosphere and increasing the temperature. And we know what causes that, and that's the burning of fossil fuels, which, of course, that's not a popular topic with the oil industry and the coal folks.
Right.
But it's a fact. It's just a fact. And, you know, North Carolina, by the way, has done a very good job here of going to renewables, particularly solar energy. As I understand it, you're number two in the country in use of solar energy, which is amazing when you compare it to Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, California. You'd think they'd be ahead of North Carolina, but North Carolina's done a pretty good job of getting on the renewable bandwagon.
And we are in the prime spot, I'm told, on the East Coast for wind power because of our coastline and where we can put windmills, although there seems to be some resistance to that.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. One of the biggest states in wind power is Texas. Mm-hmm. And if you fly, as I did a couple months ago, from the West Coast to the East Coast and pass over western Texas, you'll see all these little circular dots, and those are fracking wells. Right next to it's one of the largest wind farms in the country. There was a date back in November with all the power of Texas was supplied by wind power. All of it for one day in November because of wind. They had so much wind power generated. Yeah, pretty substantial. And what's curious about this is, who's the Secretary of Energy? Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas.
Yeah.
You'd think he'd be touting that statistic and showing how much wind power is contributing to the power of Texas. But he's kind of taken a different angle on this.
Because of oil?
Because of oil. That's correct. And the oil industry has gotten its roots into him. And
because I saw a conversation you had with, I don't remember where, it was on YouTube, and I don't remember who you were having the conversation with, but in that conversation you mentioned that in the Midwest, about 45 or so percent of the power generated out there is now from renewable resources.
Correct.
And my question is, that's real close to 50%. When it gets to 51, 52%, is that the tipping point where people wake up and say, hey, the days of fossil fuels really can come to an end now?
Well, it is the tipping point. But I think what you're seeing here is a business equation. When people realize how much they're paying to pay for gas and oil and coal in particular, and recognize that solar energy is free. I mean, it's coming from the sun. Wind power is coming from the air. You're not paying for that. You pay for the infrastructure up front, but that's a dividend that pays back for years and years and years. And a good businessman is going to say, why am I paying all this money to burn fossil fuels when I can put a solar array? I'll give you a good example. In the state just to your south, South Carolina, mm-hmm. The Boeing factory that makes Dreamliners in Charleston, South Carolina, is solar powered. Isn't that interesting? You'd think they'd be touting that a lot, but it's true. It's solar power. Now, why would Boeing, a big manufacturer, go to solar power? It's a business equation.
But aren't a lot of these energy companies, and I call them energy companies because they're not just oil companies anymore, aren't they getting into renewable energy? Don't they see the future?
Yes, and no.
Or am I wrong?
Yes and no. I mean, yes and no. I mean, you hear all the arguments about offshore drilling and searching for further oil and fracking, of course, which is I won't get into the fracking argument right now unless you want me to. So they're still searching for oil, and we're still burning oil at a terrible rate and burning gasoline at a terrible rate. But look at electric cars and how those are coming into the market big time.
But there are those who say electric cars have to have their batteries recharged, and you plug them into the grid, and the grid is powered by coal in some cases, sometimes by nuclear, sometimes by wind, sometimes by water, but mostly coal. So are we really helping the environment by having an electric car?
There's a point to that, and I understand it. My wife and I are in the process of buying a new house, and somebody said, you know, you can solar power that house and use that to recharge the battery in your car.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the perfect equation that you want. You're correct that you plug it in and your power is generated by whatever, whether it's oil or coal or nuclear. That is still a drawdown, but not as much as a polluter as it would be if you were burning gas in that car and running it out the tailpipe. As you're probably familiar, the CAFE standards, corporate adjusted fuel economy standards, were raised dramatically at the end of the Obama administration. They were aiming for 54 miles per gallon light trucks and cars by 2025. And the automobile industry supported that. It sounds a little counterintuitive, but why would they do that? Well, my point to it was they knew, one, that they could produce cars that would go get that mileage. And secondly, they knew they were going to sell millions of them. Certainly, if that was a legal requirement, people were going to buy them. So they were all in favor of it. Current administration has revoked those standards and dropped them back down, which is kind of a disappointment. But it can be done. So, I mean, it's all part of the equation.
If the federal government is taking a different approach to this, if they're rolling back regulations that the Obama administration put in place that would have improved the situation in terms of the energy use, are state governments taking the lead on this?
Yeah, I mean,
because they're going to be first impacted.
You betcha. And it's, you know, it's interesting. When we first started the road shows on this issue back when I took over ASP in 2011, our first stop was in Pittsburgh. And we were funded by somebody who said, you know, you need to get outside the Beltway and talk to the cities, the counties, and the states and see where they're at on this. And when we went into Pittsburgh, we kind of thought we'd have would not be received popularly. Went to the University of Pittsburgh, did a couple of events there, wildly sold out. Intense interest in climate change and how it was impacted. And you think Pittsburgh's not impacted by climate change? Yes, they are. They have rivers there that are overflowing. They've got a big problem with water. You know, it used to be a big coal mining area. Right. They're now fracking there, and they're having problems with that. So, I mean, the mayor of Pittsburgh got it. And the more places we went, the more we understood that the mayors understand this issue and the people understand it. And I think the states get it more so than the federal government does. And when you look, for instance, at the pullout of the Paris Accord, and there's other states that are saying, we don't support that. And we're going to pass our own regulations and support renewable energies, California perhaps being prominent among those. But I think the state, you're where the rubber meets the road.
Right.
You know, inside the Beltway, we're kind of insulated from it, if you will, and we're in the middle of the political firestorm that's going on every day now.
Right.
But once you get outside here to Charlotte, you guys can understand what's going on.
And when you used to be at Parris Island. You used to run Parris Island.
I did.
South Carolina, North Carolina, Norfolk, Virginia, et cetera, all these areas are really economically tied to the military.
Hugely.
So if the military has to move or do anything, that affects them like that. What are you hearing from state governments, from mayors directly about what they can do to help or what they can do to change the equation or what they can do to talk to Washington, et cetera?
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of history with the BRAC process, Base Realignment and Closure Process, which started in the mid-'80s. And what the Department of Defense is carrying, by some estimates, 25 to 30% excess infrastructure. They have too many bases, mm-hmm. and they're trying to consolidate and close them. Really tough to do when you're in the district of a prominent congressman,
sure.
and he does not want that base closed for your exact reason that you point out, the economic impact on his constituency. Parris Island is a really interesting one and a short story. I took it over in 1999, and here I was excited. I'd been in the recruit training business for many years. It's a great place to send young men and women. It's a fabulous training base. And so I get the turnover from my predecessor, and he's telling me what problems I'm going to have. And he says, well, your biggest problem is going to be hurricanes. They hadn't had a hurricane in 40 years. 40 years. And I said, come on, you know, really? He goes, no. He goes, you get 10,000 people on this base. And if you get a Category 5 hurricane like Floyd, you'll have a surge of 10 to 12 feet. We were 8 feet above mean sea level. You're going to be underwater. You got to move everybody. So I didn't laugh it off, but I said, what's the plan? And they did have a, we're good at planning, military services are. They had a plan to move these people. 60 days later, Floyd shows up. And we had about 48 hours to make the decision, are we going to evacuate 10,000 people and do it overnight? And got in a little tiff with the governor about declaring a state of emergency. Long story short, we got 300 to 400 buses and moved everybody off the base, moved them to Albany, Georgia. Floyd glanced us. It didn't devastate Parris Island, but it came to North Carolina.
Right.
$1 billion worth of damage, 52 people dead, cut Route 95 in half for 2 weeks. But my point to it was, here I was thinking, you know, I'm going to have problems with drill instructors or recruiting and this kind of stuff. And this guy's telling me hurricane's going to be your biggest problem. And let me one more point on this. The current commander now has a much more difficult problem because sea level rise is inundating the base. And they have just started putting out a contract to put a seawall around Parris Island. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And it's not just rain and weather and wind. It's also temperature rise, heat. When you were there, you said there were days when you could not responsibly train military guys because it was too hot.
Yeah, we have what's called flag conditions, and it starts with green, yellow, red, and black. And a black flag condition means you cannot go outside and train. It's just everybody's going to die of heat exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that, we understand it, we see what it causes. But the problem you have with that is if you can't train, you're going inside. You can't shoot on the rifle ranges. You can't do your physical training outside. I mean, it really restricts the mobility of your forces and the ability to train. And the impact here in North Carolina is very poignant because Fort Bragg, which does a lot of training, and a lot of those troops you train here deploy overseas, if they don't get the training that they need to get sped up to deploy, they can't deploy. And the more black flag days you have, the less time you train, the less deployable you are. So there's a direct impact on the mobility and readiness.
Yeah, and Fort Jackson is in the heart of Columbia, South Carolina, which is hotter and more humid than Washington, D.C.
It is. It is.
In the summertime.
It is.
So they face the same problem. Just so people will know that you are not the only person out there, former military, who talks like this. Retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn, who is also a member of your group, the American Security Project, says that the base structure of the military is absolutely essential to the generation of readiness, but that stateside bases are under threat from the consequences of climate change. I'm going to come back and talk more about that and about other things that regard climate change with our guest today, Brigadier General Stephen Cheney, in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Brigadier General Stephen Cheney, who was with the United States Marine Corps for about 30 years. He's retired and now is the CEO of the American Security Project, a nonpartisan organization that works on security issues that face the United States, among them climate change. We just talked about all the things that you've been saying and what retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn said about readiness and the importance of making sure the bases around the country are not going to be negatively impacted by climate change. Our politicians in Washington always like to wave the flag. They always like to point at our military and thank them for their service and say how important they are. And God knows the bulk of our funding, our tax dollars, goes to support the military. If the military sees this as a threat to their ability to mobilize troops and train troops and be ready for all the things that we do in the world as this great American empire that we've developed, why aren't our politicians interested in putting money forward to solve the problem?
You know, Mike, I think when you look at it, they say, one, we know what causes climate change, and we call this mitigation. Long term, you've got to mitigate the problem. So it can't be fixed overnight.
Right.
You're talking decades here to rectify this problem. And, of course, a politician, decades, that particular politician is not going to be here.
Right.
He or she is more concerned with what's going to happen next November.
Right.
In the election than they are what's going to happen 10, 20, 40 years down the pike. Well, so it's hard to get them to look that far out to figure out what the problem's going to be.
That's something we've talked about on this program before, and it's not just climate change that this is a problem. We have a structure for short-term thinking in this country, both politically and in terms of business. Can we utilize that and be successful and thrive with what's going on in the 21st century? Do we have to adopt longer-term thought and accept the consequences of that?
Oh, we certainly have to take longer-term thought on it. What's kind of curious about this, I spent a fair amount of time on the Hill educating our legislators. I get a better audience on the Senate side than I do on the House side. And it's for obvious reasons. A senator is 6 years.
Right.
House person is there, too. And I've sat down with your senators, who have been very receptive to my talks, by the way, and listened and understand it and know the impact of your bases and stations here. Although when they kind of walk that political line, they're kind of going, well, not so much I can come out in public and say I support what you're doing here. But generally speaking, they understand it. It is a tough problem, but it's not one that's insurmountable. I'm not going to be a defeatist and say it can't be done. I think as you see the renewables start coming in, you see more businesses taking it on. That will impact the election cycle, and it will impact your politics.
So it's going to come from the private sector.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
Going to come from
absolutely.
Business. Prior to President Trump taking office, you wrote an article in which you said that as CEO of the American Security Project, you looked to providing the Trump administration with relevant advice and solutions. Have you had that opportunity?
Yeah, I won't say it isn't for lack of trying. We have certainly made approaches to both DOD and Department of State in particular and talked to not the highest level, but maybe one or two levels down, to some of the political appointees that's actually been a little bit receptive. Mm. Hasn't obviously been as positive as it was in the last administration. But they're... They'll listen, I'll put it that way. They might not appreciate what you're saying or want what you're saying. But
do they seem to get it? Or they just look, I mean, do they understand it, but they see the political realities that they face and therefore cannot or will not act on it? Or do they just not get it?
No, I don't think it's a fact of just not getting it.
Okay.
Most of them are fairly bright, articulate people, understanding, but they support a different political perspective on this issue. And are a little bit reticent to go against their leader.
You say that this problem of climate change, both as a security problem and just as a problem to life on Earth, is solvable.
It is.
You really believe that?
Sure. It is. I'll give you two really real-life examples. When I first got stationed at Camp Pendleton, California, early 70s, we had days where the smog would come down from Los Angeles and inundate Camp Pendleton. And you could see it almost on a daily basis. Mid-80s, it was not as bad. Mid-90s, it was not bad at all. Today, they're clear as a bell. And you'd say, what changed? Catalytic converters changed it. When they went to the emission standards on cars, they stopped the CO2 going to the atmosphere. And the smog, it's not totally disappeared in L.A., but it's not much there as in the past. Let's go over to Asia and Beijing and talk about the Olympics. Here they stop all cars for 2 weeks and trucks and coal burning. The sky's clear. Everything's nice. They have the Olympics. They go right back to where they were.
Right.
We know what's causing that. If you continue to do that on a daily basis, and China's got a very unique problem, as you're probably familiar with power generation. They are building coal plants, but they're also huge in the renewable side of the house. Okay. Of course, we just put a tax on solar panels coming in from China, which didn't help the industry here at all. But nonetheless, we know what's causing that, and it's CO2 emissions, and we know what's causing the CO2 emissions. It's burning of fossil fuels. So hey, you stop that, you will fix this.
And one of the keys, you say, to solving this is obviously worldwide cooperation, and one of the keys to that was the Paris Accord,
sure.
Which, of course, the Trump administration has elected to pull out of. But we really can't get out of it for about 8 years. So it will be the next administration who could reverse it if they wanted to. But in the meantime, we're kind of a lame duck member of this organization. If the U.S. is not part of the solution, can the solution be found?
Oh, certainly it can. Although we're, the number two or three emitter in the world behind China and India. So those two countries, which are signatories to the Paris Accord, understand the problem. And the world was looking to us for leadership on this issue and others, and we've abandoned that leadership position. We don't have a seat at the table. But I will tell you from my travels all over the world, particularly in Europe, they say, okay, we know we've got the problem. At least we're not going to abandon this ship. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you say, I think they look long-term and go, with time, this administration will change, and the people will begin to understand what a problem it is.
Well, the president kept saying it was such a terrible deal for the United States. It was unfair to the United States. The restrictions being placed on the United States were far more detrimental than they were to other countries. Was that true?
That's a gross exaggeration, and it's pointedly not true. These were standards applied all the way across. You set your own standards by the Paris Accord, by the way. Most of that you apply. You set your own standards. The government.
Do his comments come from ignorance of that fact, or do they come because he simply has a different point of view and he'll say anything to make that point of view?
The latter and not the former.
Okay. You say that sticking with the Paris Climate Agreement is in America's best interest in terms of both security and the economy to remain on the path toward a cleaner future, which makes logical sense to me. So when you hear people deny that, does it make your head spin?
Spin wildly. Yeah, sure it makes my head spin. But again, I think the original premise for the establishment of the American Security Project was, from Kerry's perspective, is okay, they're not going to listen to me. Maybe they'll listen to you guys. Who,
are they listening?
They are. Some are. Some aren't.
More so than to John Kerry Vice President Gore?
I would say so. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Those two names, and I don't mean to denigrate this organization, the Sierra Club,
right,
or Greenpeace, but when you mention those to people, they all go, "Oh my God, these are these left wing environmentalists that are attacking ships and saving the whales and all that." We're not into that at ASP. We're into national security here.
Well,
let's not go too far one way.
And the right wing is into national security, and they're into business. So this makes business sense. It makes national security sense. Why aren't they on board?
Ask the businesses. But I'll give you another example, and it's FedEx, which their long-term aim is to run all their aircraft on biofuels. And Fred Smith from FedEx, there's an organization called Secure America's Future Energy Safe. You can Google it. That has a retired Marine Commandant on its board, among others, that talk about biofuels and running them in aircraft in particular. You know, the number one consumer of fossil fuels in this country.
It's military.
That's right. It's the Department of Defense.
Yes.
And what's kind of curious about that, although in the whole spectrum of things that it's a minor player when you consider how many cars there are in the world or how many aircraft are. But nonetheless, as a single entity, it's the biggest burner of fossil fuels. They are getting into the biofuel side of the house. Now, there was a hue and cry about, why are we doing this? And, well, one, you want to reduce emissions, but secondly, you don't want to have the dependency that you have on fossil fuels. And the price of biofuels is coming down dramatically. Mm-hmm. And we think at ASP, within the next 5 years, it'll certainly be equal to a gallon of diesel or a gallon of gas.
To solve this problem would seem to take a lot of money. Am I wrong?
I think you are wrong.
Okay.
Look at the people that are using solar and wind and the investment that it's paying back on that. And it's you're not talking trillions of dollars here. You might be talking, I won't say billions, but for a company like Boeing, for instance, to put solar power on top of its factory in Charleston, they saw it as a long-term win-win.
Okay.
They saved money. They made the investment.
What I have to ask this question because I have to be fair. What if you're wrong? What if people like you and people who say the same things that you're saying today are wrong? What if this turns around in 10 years and we start to cool off because of the natural cycle of the earth? What if you're wrong and we put all this effort and time and money into this?
Sure. Well, I would start on the business side of the house. When you're saving money by using solar and wind power instead of burning gas, so you're not paying the money to drill or to refine the gas or to put it into your cars or burn it to have fuel. So you're saving money from that perspective. So, I mean, it's not a lost investment from that perspective if you're wrong. But the kicker, Mike, is with the statistics over the last 120 years or so, when you look at it, it's hard to say we're wrong here, that this is all of a sudden gonna flip.
So let's be clear here. You're not a scientist, and you've said this. You spent your life in the military, in the Marine Corps. You've run military bases. You've worked for the State Department. You've worked with the CIA, etc. Why has this issue become so important to you? Simply because the military sees this as a national security issue?
Well,
And you work with other issues, too. Let's be clear about that, too.
We do. We were at a dinner last night with the World Affairs Council and the Nature Conservancy, and one of the attendees said, what are you going to tell my grandkids? You know, what's the sales pitch to them and their my son and his parent? He's the parents of the grandkids. Mm-hmm. How are you going to influence the influencers is the word we use here. And that's the point that, you know, for me, I'm on the tail end of my lifespan here. So we're not going to fix this problem in the next 10 or 15 years. But if we don't start now, right, we will never fix it. And the people who will be impacted are your grandkids.
So it seems like we take a step forward and then two steps back, or maybe two steps forward and one step back. I'm not sure what the equation is. But The Independent, which is a UK publication, recently printed that the Pentagon has edited a report drafted during the Obama administration to take out all references to climate change. And then the Washington Post, just I think a week ago, reported that this unpublished report was written in 2016. When it was presented to Congress earlier this year, the 23 references to climate change found in the draft had been removed. That de-emphasized the military's focus on adapting to rising sea levels at military bases around the world, among other things. So who would have ordered those changes, and why would the Pentagon have removed them if they really believe that this is the case?
It's your political appointees that have come in the incumbent administration.
But they're feeding incorrect information to people who are making major decisions. Why would the Pentagon not scream it from the rooftops and say, look, that's not what we said. That's not what's in that report.
Yeah, I read that article, by the way, and I saw those references, and I've read all those publications as well. And they have scrubbed the two words climate change from it. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they know the sea level is rising. They know that there's droughts that are causing conflict. So if you're not going to point to those specific two words, you still know that something's causing this and there's a problem there. There might be a different word for it. Heating, global warming, mm-hmm, not climate change, which has turned into the hot two words for the incumbent administration. Okay, call it something else. We don't care. We want you to fix the problem, do the mitigation that's going to stop causing the heating.
Of course, the president has promised to bring back coal, which is never going to happen. Coal is over. And I don't know why he wouldn't want to focus his attention on helping retrain coal miners to develop solar panel and put up windmills and things like that. But he wants to do coal. If coal were returned to prominence, what would that mean?
Well, for starters, coal is not going to return to prominence. It's an oxymoron, clean coal. There is no such thing.
Right.
I mean, there just is no such thing. And again, this is the president pandering to his base, particularly the West Virginia miners, if you will, saying, I'm going to save you. I'm going to revitalize the coal industry. It's a business proposition.
Yes.
Who's paying to do that? And I don't know anybody.
But aren't there more solar and renewable energy jobs than there are fossil fuel jobs in America?
That's correct. So, which is a statistic they don't like to tout, but it's true.
But why not, if it's true?
Well,
and why not push the envelope a little bit? Why not make political hay by pushing the envelope in that direction?
Well, I think sooner or later you will see that industry will become so prolific. There'll be so many employees, so many folks, that they will be the majority that, frankly, they're going to end up voting too, and they will change the vote on the coal industry business.
You have said that we must get ahead of climate change, and we must act now to reduce carbon emissions. Can we do that in the absence of political leadership, really? I mean, fast enough?
Well, yes, you can. I think the business community and the people that are impacted will say, hey, we're not going to pay for a coal burning industry right here. We're going to go another route. And so that will bubble up it'll be from the bottom up. That will push this issue without political leadership. But I think as it's gaining traction, and certainly gaining traction here, that your political leaders are going to understand it.
Brigadier General Stephen Cheney, who's the CEO now of the American Security Project. Good luck to you in your efforts, and go Titans.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike.